This is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. The title of this product is God as the Artist. Its designation is T as in Thomas 61. God as Artist. The purpose of this production is to give some insight into the way that God works. Let me rephrase that. To give an insight into a way that God works. Let me rephrase that once again. To give what, in my opinion, is an insight into a way that God works. It may be unnecessary to add that I believe or feel that this insight is worthwhile for you to know. Sometimes it is prudent to make a distortion in order to get at an underlying truth. In fact, this is one of the principles of art. Therefore, please keep in mind also that this work is a distortion of only one aspect of the God-man relationship. Let me emphasize strongly that I am dealing with the method of communication from God to man. I am not concerned with the content. So, I am concerned with the journey and not the end goal. The reason why I say this is that the end goal, the content of God's revelation to man, is not subject to such an examination as this one is. What God has conveyed to man is the deposit of faith. Man is obligated to accept totally the deposit of faith. Again, I am not concerned with that. I am concerned with the way God has chosen to present that faith to us. Let me begin with some observations which I believe will set up a proper context. Let me state an axiom. The Bible contains apparent, quote, contradictions, unquote. By this I mean some things which, if taken literally and without the guidance of God's grace, can be considered mutually exclusive. I am not saying that these are real contradictions. They can be resolved, of course. I simply point out that they do exist. From this axiom, I mention the following. Anti-Catholics will sometimes use these problem passages to attack the faith. They will even use them to attack Protestant beliefs. Their argument is as follows. If the Holy Book contains errors, then it cannot be trusted. And if it cannot be trusted, then either the God of the Bible is not the real God, or he is not God enough to keep his book correct, as in free from error. Either way, this is a way that the non-believer attacks God and his church. It is a way by which the non-believer will attack one support of our faith, namely the Bible. Yet the Bible is not always, shall I say, clear and direct in its contents. As many scholars have pointed out, although it contains historical facts, it is not really a history book. It contains poetry and metaphorical language, but it is not really a book of literature. It is a book of truth. Yet such things, poetry and metaphorical language, may introduce the problem of misunderstanding. When is the Bible to be taken literally, and when is it poetic? I am not solving these problems here and now. I am simply mentioning them because such problems, if this is the correct word, are central to this work. They are part of the context of this work. Of course, those who attack God and his church are not good people. They are in the same category as those who found false religions, for example, Mohammed. To help develop the subject, let me stay with the illustration of Mohammed for a moment. Mohammed wrote the Quran under one of only two possible inspirations, either purely human invention, namely his own, or satanic. Let me for a moment consider that he was his own inspiration. Mohammed, regardless of what else he was or was not a stupid man. He was one of the greatest personalities who ever lived. He is one of the few people who, all by himself, has managed to change all history. So he must be considered intelligent enough not to have problem passages of the type similar to those in the Bible, in his Quran. What I mean by this is that he should be smart enough to avoid the problem. But he does have such problem passages. To put this slightly differently, the evil person should not himself do in his own written work what he criticizes in the true religion. He should correct the defects. Yet the Quran, and I am using it as only one example, and all other holy books, I believe, also contain such problem passages. Certainly Muhammad could have edited the Quran before he died. After he died, one of his successors did destroy unauthorized editions of the Quran, so that there is to this day only one official version. The editors could have eliminated any problem passages, but did not. Again, this is not my point. My point is that Muhammad holds that the Bible is a holy book from God, but has become corrupted over time. And Muhammad, as the last prophet, was called by God to straighten out the matter. What happens here is that the evil counterfeit book ends up having some of the same, quote, defects, unquote, as the real one. And this is despite the fact that this new prophet was supposed to straighten out everything which had become confused. Why, then, does the Quran have difficult passages? I mentioned that Muhammad could have only two possible inspirations. They are his own evil inclinations or Satan. Either way, the inspiration is both evil and, in a certain sense, the work of an antichrist. By this, I mean the evil person offers his work as being truly from God, when in fact it is not. I deal with the issue of antichrist in another work. Let me now offer a particular observation of mine. One reason why I believe that Satan would not correct the problem passages is that Satan will often appear as an angel of light. This means that he imitates God's way of doing things. Satan does not always do this, but sometimes he does. And an antichrist will imitate the actions of God. However, I may be slightly off the subject, so let me return to it. I am simply offering as my first observation the interesting fact that both real and false holy books contain problem passages. Because of this fact, these books open themselves up to criticism. This is my first observation. Let me present another, and keep in mind that I am only trying to establish a context. Imagine yourself entering a museum of art or a gallery. You see the first painting, and instead of a painting proper, you see a canvas with the following words on it: charity is good. You go to the next painting and you see the words, don't despair. You go on and every painting is the same. All you see are words painted on framed canvases. You agree with every expression. All the comments or advice are ethical and more moral, or express some timeless truth. Instead of flowers, you read that flowers are pretty. Instead of a storm at sea, you read, storms at sea can be very impressive. How would you feel? You would feel cheated. That isn't art. It is not that the messages aren't true. They are. It is that you would object to the way in which the messages are presented. Again, you would feel that it is not the end goal which is wrong, but the journey in getting there is inadequate. However, the best art does convey such messages. One of the problems with so-called modern art is its lack of message. For example, you may have seen, as I have, canvases which have nothing on them but a big number 5. And the title is Big Number 5. The problem with such efforts is that we cannot see how well the artist has conveyed his message. The number 5 carries no message. In this case, there is no journey at all and no real goal either. It is simply there. And all it is the number 5. You are presented with a fact which carries no truth nor pleasure. It requires nothing of you. The first type of painting, the one with the true phrases, at least requires you to read and understand. The second kind does nothing at all. So I ask, how would you feel if you entered a gallery which had only the kind of modern, quote, art, unquote, as I have described? If you have any taste, then you would feel as cheated as you would if you had entered the gallery with only messages. So the conclusion is this: art, real art, needs to contain two things. One is a message, and, for what I will call, for lack of a better term, the pleasing part. I take it as axiomatic that art, real art, has a core of truth in its message. So art needs a truth element and an aesthetic element. There has to be something which reflects reality beyond, that is separated from, the work of art, whether it be natural or supernatural, whether it be ideal or real. I'm using their terms in their philosophical senses. And then there is a requirement that this insight into reality be expressed in a way that you find pleasing. I take it for granted that I am dealing with worthwhile art. By this I mean that art which would convey an immoral message would not be art. So pornography, no matter how well done, would not be art. Nor would a Protestant hymn, no matter how well composed, be art if it contained doctrinal error. If the words were removed, then it might become art. In other words, would the mere music of some Protestant hymn without the words possibly be a work of art? This is, perhaps, an interesting question, but it is not the one with which I deal now. I am making simplifications simply to get to my main theme. Let me go back to the art and your reaction to it. The real work of art may at first appear to be simply there, and that it does nothing. In fact, it does interact with you, the observer. It literally invites you to react and judge and feel and conclude. It asks you to observe carefully and analyze. It asks, do you get what I am saying? Have I done it well? Do you enjoy the journey to the goal which I offer you? This may seem rather extreme, but it is not. We all tend to do this automatically, almost in a reflex action, so that we are no longer self-conscious when we do it. But we do do it. I take you back to the gallery. Now when you walk in, you see a painting representing the story of the Good Samaritan. You see one man bending down to help another who is injured. You see compassion on one face and gratitude and hope on the other. Now you see a pictorial representation and you, quote, read, unquote, the message of charity is good. That is to say, you get the message. The next painting shows a noble barbarian chief bound and captive before some Roman general. You see a man facing his death. His body and his expression, in his body and in his expression, you read bravery and loyalty to a cause. You read, be brave when you are tempted to despair. Now please compare the two events, your reactions to the gallery with the painted words and the real art. The only real difference between these two events is that in one case you were active and took a journey, while in the other you were bought passively to the end goal. Clearly, you would enjoy the second event when you had to read into the works of art more than the first where you merely read words. With this in mind, let me make some general comments on the nature of art. I believe that some of these comments have already been published in the Non-Republic, also known as Analysis and Explanations. If you enjoy such material, you should consider subscribing to this. The artistic effort requires that the artist be convinced that he has something worthwhile to produce and to present to you. Then what he needs to then he needs to conceal what he has. Then he presents you with a map by which you may find what is concealed. If he does not conceal his message, then we do not have art, but only painted words on a canvas. A very simple way to think of this is to consider a pirate's buried treasure and his treasure map. What the artist has to do is to decide how hidden the thing should be and how clear the map should be. That is why art is an art and not a science. Allow me briefly to distinguish between the two. In this context, a science is an effort in which the actor has no effect on the end result. For example, it makes no difference who strikes the match. The flame comes forth anyway. Art is an effort. in which the actor has a significant effect on the end result. This is not to say that artistic efforts cannot be guided by certain general rules, which may even be offered as laws. There are such rules. There are concepts of composition and contrast, of perspective and harmony, etc. I am simply saying that the great artist can produce greater works of art than can the average artist. Again, the goal may be exactly the same, but your journey in getting there is far more pleasing when the art is presented to you by the superior artist. The greater the artist, the greater is his talent, and the more pleasing the end result. As should be obvious, a great artist can, and maybe even should, dare to attempt more difficult efforts than would be attempted by the average artist. I recall one critic commenting on Mozart. He said something to the effect that he, Mozart, was working within the limitations which all geniuses impose upon themselves. The way I understood this was that Mozart found merely producing, quote, pretty music, unquote, to be not enough of a challenge. Thus, he included internal problems, which he had, so to speak, to conquer, in order to achieve the effect. This might be using a piano in a new way, or limiting himself to a certain format. The painter is bound by the size of his canvas. The artist welcomes the limitations as a challenge. It gives him a chance to show off his talent. So what I am offering is that great artists welcome difficult tasks and find satisfaction in viewing the goal in such a way that it requires greater rather than lesser effort on the part of the viewer. Of course, usually the great artist can be appreciated by the, quote, vulgar peasant, unquote, also. To those who do not understand or appreciate classical music, Mozart may be merely pretty music. However, the classical musician appreciates more of what he has done than those of us who have no such background or training. I paraphrase a quote from Mozart describing one of his works. He said that the non-experts, that is, those who do not study classical music, will appreciate it along with the experts. However, the peasants simply will not know why they like the work so much. Art, good art, may have levels which are appreciated by people of different abilities. It can be a subject of study as well as merely being appreciated and enjoyed. This is my context, and I hope that it is clear. Let me now present my major premise. Let me advance a biblical reason for presenting God as an artist. What an artist does is to use something which already exists and transforms it so that it takes on a new nature. Even the composer does this when he uses musical instruments to bring his composition into reality. The analogy which I believe is most important is that of a sculptor. The sculptor takes some material and molds it into a different shape. Notice how the book of Genesis records the act of human creation. God takes dust or clay and breathes into it. It seems self-evident that this had to require a reshaping of the material, as clay does not naturally exist in the shape of a human body. We all know that God can create by calling something into existence which did not exist before. God says, "Let there be light," and there was. But God used pre-existent material, as an artist does, to create man. As with all things in the Bible, there has to be a meaning to this passage. One possible explanation is the one which I am offering. Namely, that God behaves like an artist, and one way better to understand the ways of God is to realize this. Let me now present a series of separate, but I hope related, observations and aspects. I take it for granted that the most important relationship between God and man is that one which brings about man's salvation. At times, this may seem, incorrectly, that it is one which is brought about by man's own efforts, that is, by works. At the other extreme is the hard predestinationist view, that man can do nothing to sustain or lose his salvation once it is granted by God. To attempt to bring in another way of looking at this, let me use the artist analogy. The artist, all by himself, creates the work of art. Yet it remains, shall I say, unfulfilled. until it is seen and appreciated by the men. The work itself gains nothing by being viewed or heard by men. However, the fulfillment of the work requires some action by men other than the creator. This is one reason why I've referred to the artist as a creator. It is similar to the reproduction of a human being. Although the child is created in the womb, until he enters the world of men by birth, we do not consider him a fully functioning human being. There is a social aspect to life and art. People react to both art and other people. And this artistic reaction requires an act of will. The viewer must be willing, if he is to appreciate the work, to accept the standards that the artist has followed. Let me explain further. There is an immense difference between grand opera and other music, for example, Broadway show tunes, and between either of these and country western music, the difference is even greater. But this does not mean that one is necessarily better than the other. However, it does mean that if a critic is to evaluate one effort in one genre, he must not use the same standards that he would use of the others. One does not judge a portrait painting by the same standards that one would judge a landscape, and one does not expect Wagner's Ring at Branson, Missouri. But not only the critic, but the average viewer-listener must adopt different standards when he is presented with different types of art. The artist is in an odd situation. He is both dictator and supplicant. He dictates the type of art, the theme, the execution, and the goal. Then he offers this to the viewer and asks for a type of approval. He declares himself to be special and above others in ability, and then offers himself and makes himself vulnerable to rejection, criticism, mockery, and failure. When we look at the public life of our Lord, we see many of these same elements. The Lord of all, who can dictate any terms he wills, offers himself in a way in which he can be utterly rejected by those who refuse to accept the standards by which the issue should be judged. I offer another observation. Art has a series of levels. By this I mean that art can be appreciated on different levels. This depends on the education of the viewer. For example, the reaction can range from simple enjoyment to a full understanding of the problems overcome in the effort. In the play Amadeus, the only one who fully appreciates the works of Mozart is Salieri. It's because he is a fellow composer, but not as talented. He understands the difficulty of creating beautiful music. To the other characters, the music is nice, but to Salieri, the music is sublime. In the same sense, the creation of God can be appreciated simply as a gift and appreciated on the surface level. However, the scientist should have a better appreciation of the same things, as he should understand more of the complexity and beauty of nature and creation. I offer another observation. Art also is, by definition, limited. I referred to this before, but I mean it in a different way this time. I mean that the artist limits his work in a certain way that the viewer cannot exceed. One cannot expect to hear a painting or see a concert. The viewer must, if he is to understand the work at all, accept these limitations placed upon him by the artist. The viewer cannot demand something from the artist beyond the medium the artist has chosen. In this sense, the artist dictates to the viewer, and the viewer has really only two choices, namely to accept or reject. This places the viewer in a submissive posture with regard to the artist. By his selection of the medium, the artist limits what the message will be. A painting simply cannot convey the same message, or at least not in the same way as a concert. There is, of course, a certain overlapping in that both may convey a general message for example, be loyal. However, even then, usually the viewer or listener needs some background to understand the message. For example, a child who knows nothing of Julius Caesar will not understand how an actor and director can convey the character of Brutus as either a patriot or a traitor. Unless the work of art is somehow a thing all by itself, some context is necessary for the viewer to approach it. This means that the viewer has to do some work to understand the artist's effort. This is in addition to the act of submission by which he accepts the artist's choices. However, in a sense, want the acts of submission has made the roles reverse. The viewer then is pleased and served by the artist in that the pleasing aspect of the work now becomes real rather than merely potential to the viewer. I will comment on the matter of art which is not pleasing in a moment. My point now is that there is a certain rigid necessary sequence in these matters. First, the artist chooses the medium. This necessarily limits the entire subject in the ways that the viewer has to accept. Second, the viewer willingly accepts the choice of medium and then agrees to the limitations and standards offered by the artist in his work. Third, the viewer is then pleased by the work. I have mentioned the concept of art pleasing the viewer several times, but some art is not intended to do so. In fact, some art, as in the classical tragedies in the theater, are intended to do sorrow and tears in the audience. This may seem to violate my premise. However, I am advancing a sense of pleasure in the broadest sense. By this I mean what is good for you, and what is good for you will bring you the ultimate pleasure. Thus, the torments of the martyr are pleasurable, not pleasurable while he endures them, but they do bring about a greater pleasure, salvation and glory in heaven. Real art may, by its displeasure, bring about a greater pleasure. It is not pleasant to hear the first part of the story of the Good Samaritan. It involves pain, crime, loss, and indifference. But the second part pleases us. Artistic representations of the crucifixion are unpleasant, but the resurrection is glorious. In this sense, the prelude to the climax may be unpleasant, yet still be both a work of art and one which ultimately pleases us. This is a way to distinguish between art and pornography. Art has the goal of a good pleasure, even if delayed or indirect, while pornography has the goal of immediate and bad pleasure. My point here is that art is literally inseparable from pleasure. One way to measure art is by how much pleasure it induces, even if there is a long and evolving process. I need to add one warning here. I have mentioned that the effect of art may be an evolving process. Art, however, is not and never can be a process of evolution. By this I mean that a work of art is a distinct process brought about by an intentional act of will of an intelligent being. Evolution is none of these. This is one reason why one can understand the proper creationist view of the origin of things is so opposed to the evolutionist view. Allow me one observation, final observation. I take it as axiomatic that the appreciation of art is a sign of a cultured and completed man. It is one of the higher aspects of the human intellect. Art is good and can bring about an improvement in man's living conditions and improvement in men themselves. And this applies both to the artist and the viewer, that is, the audience. I have exhausted my observations. Allow me to draw some conclusions. God does, in at least some ways, function as an artist. He hides some information and encourages man to see it, to discover it. The hidden information, notice the Catholic tradition of referring to the dogmas as mysteries of the faith, is valuable and leads to ultimate pleasure. This activity involves man more in the revelation process and can and does lead to an improvement of man himself. God acts as both dictator and servant, as the artist does. As art is a higher function of man, so it is appropriate that God would function in an artistic way. Also, the enemies of God, in imitating him, will imitate this aspect also, that the artistic function or attempts at it can be used by both sides. The following are related ARM products which you may wish to obtain: the audio tape Art, the audio tape The Submissive God, and the audio tape The Philosophical Primer. Thank you. God bless.